Hello and welcome to Table Talk. I'm Olivia Potts.
And I'm Laura Prendergast.
Today we are delighted to be joined by Chris Atkins. Chris is a British journalist and documentary filmmaker, films including Taking Liberties and Starsuckers, the last of which saw him give evidence to the Leveson Inquiry. In 2016, he was sentenced to 5 years in prison for tax offences. His book, A Bit of a Stretch, recounts his time in HMP Wandsworth. Chris, thank you for coming to Table Talk.
Thanks so much for having me.
Chris, we'll start where we always start, which is at the beginning. What was food like when you were growing up?
Noisy, I suppose, is my earliest memory. Both my parents were teachers. In fact, my dad still is. But my dad taught at the local private school and my mum taught at the local comprehensive. So Table was where sort of these colliding political ideals kind of came out. So I always remember mealtimes being very, very lively affairs. And it's where I sort of learned my sort of argumentative side, maybe. So mealtimes were always quite noisy.
What was your mother like as a cook?
Oh, my mum was an excellent cook. And she grew up in a very, very poor household. Both her parents were miners. So she, you know, could make her own bread. She just made everything from scratch. So she cooked for us the entire time. And could rustle amazing meals out of next to nothing in the larder. So, yeah, I would never be as good a cook as her, but throughout my sort of university years, my early 20s, I sort of slightly fell out with my mum. But the way we got back together again was me trying to make lasagna, screwing it up and calling up, going, oh, back on my sauce, how do you do it? Put the flour in first, put the butter in first. Oh, no, how long do I cook this for? So, yeah, food sort of, when we had our falling out, food was always kind of brings back together again.
And as a child, were you a fussy eater or would you eat anything?
I think I was as a young child, and it's weird now I have a son of my own. He's very fussy, but I ate healthily, if that makes sense. So I wouldn't eat a lot, but we ate lots of raw vegetables for some reason. My parents thought it'd be a good idea for us to have raw vegetables. So all my vegetables had to be raw. And my own son's in a similar place. But I actually think that's not so bad. At least you're eating fresh fruit and veg, you know, and at some point you'll suddenly realise the cooked tomatoes are lovely. So, but I remember having to discover that for myself. I remember being told cooked tomatoes are lovely, and I thought, no, they're absolutely disgusting.
Never.
And then when I was about 18, I tried them and went, oh, these are great. So I think you've got to just allow them to walk through the door themselves. As long as there's some fresh fruit and veg and they don't, I'm a sugar Nazi, and don't let my son eat many sort of crisps and sweets. My parents were the same as well. So I think if you've got those core basics, it doesn't matter if people are a bit fussy.
And what about school food? You went to Bromsgrove in Worcestershire when you were boarding. What was school food like?
Yeah, it wasn't massively different from prison food. I have to say, maybe in some ways prison food was better. School dinners, I mean, yeah, all the absolute cliches. And there was a whole thing in my school about the timing. Again, it's very prison-like, but the timings about when each house were in houses, you can remember such a thing, and when each house went in, and if you were the house that went in last at sort of 12:30 or whenever it was, rather than at 12. By then, the food was all cold and it was all congealed and there was hardly anything left. And it was the same in prison. When if you're the last wing to go in, there'd be nothing there. So there was all the little tricks and scams that people deployed to try and get in to lunch early.
A good preparation.
A good preparation, same in prison, try and get in food early. So yeah, it was pretty grim, but I learned then, it's if you could be first at the table, you'd probably get the best bite.
And you studied physics at Oxford, mm-hmm. and at some point discovered cooking and spoke to your mum about lasagna.
Yeah, yeah.
How did that come about? How did you start learning how to cook?
Well, I think like a lot of people, you sort of go to university and just think that food magically materialises on the table all by itself, in the same way that underwear cleans itself and puts itself in the drawer and floors get hoovered. So it was just being on my own and sort of having to sort of cook with my friends that I suddenly realised I wasn't very good at it. So yeah, there were a lot of evening calls to my mum in a blind panic telling me how to sort out the dishes. But also, you know, it was a nice communal experience. And I think maybe in this sort of screen infested world, that's something people miss, I guess. But certainly when I was at university, none of us had phones, none of us had laptops, you know, and everyone would just get together and chuck in a few quid in the evening and take it in turns to cook a meal. So I wasn't very good at it, and that was quite apparent, so I needed to up my game.
You went on to make lots of documentaries. What's food like when you're making a documentary? Is there kind of catering, or do you have to fare for yourself?
A lot of pub lunches, because my career is quite odd, because I actually started in drama. I made quite a lot of drama films first and then moved into documentaries. And for a lot of people, it's the other way around. They do docs first and think, I can't wait to get into drama. So when you're on drama films, it's a massive deal. You need to get catering trucks and you need to sort of spend a huge amount of money. And it's the thing that always the crew always complain about. You know, you get your main kind of crew mutinies over food normally. So it's always a very, very touchy subject on drama films. But on docs, it's great because there's only two or three of you. My best friend, Chris Smith, is cameraman on all my docs. So normally I'm making a doc at the moment and it's literally just me and Chris going around the country interviewing interesting people. So we just find a nice pub and go and have some lunch somewhere.
Tell us how you ended up in prison.
Well, it wasn't because of my cooking. but if that was the case, I might have got 10 years. So short version is, you mentioned very kindly, there was a film I made about 11 years ago called Starsuckers, which was a polemical documentary entertaining sort of critique of the tabloid press, amongst other things. And we couldn't get funding for it, so we engaged with a tax avoidance scheme that was designed to enable celebrities and bankers to pay less tax by sort of funneling their money through films. And these schemes have quite rightly come under a lot of criticism because a lot of them are sort of bending and in some cases breaking the rules in order to maximise the returns for these rich people. And we got engaged with one of those and it kind of crossed the line. And, you know, we paid the price, really.
When the trial was ongoing, mm-hmm. it was, as you describe in your book, a particularly difficult time for you, perhaps unsurprisingly.
Yeah, yeah.
And you talk about not really eating during the trial.
No.
And you were found guilty and were on bail between the verdict and the sentence.
Yeah.
You're then brought in for sentencing and you received a 5-year sentence.
Yeah.
At that point, you're taken down into the custody cells to await going to prison.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the first time you eat with gusto that you describe in the book. Can you tell us about your first experience?
My first experience. It was great. I mean, as you said, I hadn't eaten during the trial, and I often say that the trial's a lot worse than prison, oddly enough, because at least in prison you know your fate.
Mm.
And even though I was on bail during my trial, so I was going home every night and I was still seeing my son, the kind of the pressure of the uncertainty was crippling. I mean, entirely self-induced. And when you get found guilty and sentenced, there's a huge sense of relief. And I didn't plan this or decide this, but my appetite suddenly came back. I suddenly found that I could eat again. And I really was wasting away. I mean, I came out of prison. Everyone says, you look so much better than when you went in. And that's true. And I've seen, you know, the photos of me on the court steps. And I think, oh, my God, I look like sort of Gollum in a suit. So yeah, and a lot of that, you know, I was drinking, I was smoking a lot. And as I said, not eating. So when you suddenly get to eat, it's like you can sort of eat with some certainty. And the problem is in these cells, and I'm not complaining, they are court cells, they're not supposed to be nice, but there's nothing to eat off. There's no light little table or anything. So I was in my suit and I had to balance this microwave tray on my knees. It was scalding hot, so I was sort of eating off my knees and I hardly ever wear suits anyway. So I was eating like a dog off this thing, and I got a lot of it on my court clothes. And this actually stayed on my court clothes for 2.5 years, these stains. It's like they're forever encrusted.
Because those court clothes went back into a box and only came out when you returned from confiscation.
And I kept trying to throw them away, and they're like, no, you've got to keep them. I was like, they're going to give someone cholera. I mean, this isn't healthy. So yes, these stains were sort of enshrined forevermore from this first meal, symbolically.
And can you take us through sort of your first week in prison? What were your kind of first impressions of the food? What was the kind of daily routine?
Well, I had no idea what to expect because my only experience of prison was really through popular culture. So I'd seen Shawshank Redemption, I'd seen Porridge, and thought, oh, well, I know this. Of course, it's nothing like that at all. And one of the most shocking things wasn't the quality of the food, because I'm not that fussy. I can eat anything, really. But it was the quantity. And I'm not a big eater either. I'm quite a skinny guy. So it's not like I need tons and tons of food anyway. But what really shocked me, this is the official portions that the prison give you, the official meals that the prison give you. It's not enough to feed a child. And that I did find really, really shocking. And there's an induction booklet, which I always said is one of the greatest works of fiction that I've ever read. It sort of explains to you what to expect in prison. And it's just, it's nothing in it is true whatsoever. I've still got to say, it's hilarious. And it says in there, you know, we have budgeted £2.54, I think it was, per prisoner per day to feed them. So that's, you know, why it's not great. But don't worry, this gives you everything a grown adult needs to eat. And I say, if I gave it to my child, I'd be prosecuted for parental neglect. So that was the thing. It was just these derisory tiny portions. I mean, it was cold and it was horrible, but above all, it was the quantity or the lack of the quantity that I found most shocking.
And the mealtimes are bonkers to any
completely.
To any normal person.
Completely, yeah. Like everything in prison, it's completely backwards. So you get your breakfast pack the night before, and the breakfast pack, again, it's a bit of a generous term, but it's a sort of plastic bag, a lot of disposable plastics. David Attenborough would be very upset. All these polythene bags. So you have a few tea bags in there, and they weren't great tea bags, and you knew they weren't great because you had these blue mugs, and after you'd had about three cups of tea, they were like black on the inside, and you're thinking, oh my God, is that my stomach? Yeah, exactly. It's like, is this tar inside this? And they didn't have coffee sachets, which I was quite annoyed about because I like my coffee. But there was sugar in there. And then there was a small cart, I call them fun-sized cartons of milk, but I think it was 125 millilitres. I mean, it was a tiny amount of milk. And then you had a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of cereal as well. So that was your quote-unquote breakfast. And then you could sort of have that whenever, but you got that the night before. And then lunch was always a weird time. Lunch was always sort of 11 to 11.30. And I'm just trying to remember, that was a hot, quote-unquote hot meal, where you had to leave your cell and you would go down to the landing below and there was a small servery there. And I think they picked the people to work on the servery based on who had the most skin diseases, really. I mean, it was astonishing, the people. And not only that, but you'd also seen the same guy like 20 minutes later walking around with the hands down the trousers. Now, this to me was quite odd. And since I've got out, I've seen actually kids walking around with their hands down the trousers. I realise it's a thing, but in prison, everyone had their hands down the trousers. And I went, you've just done that, and now you're serving me food. Have you washed the anti-back here? And so anyway, so they would serve this up, and then if you're lucky, you get a slice or two of bread, white sliced bread. Again, as a middle-class person, I was thinking, is there any seeded batch here?
Sourdough.
I know. So there was the bread, and then you would then take this, but there wasn't anywhere, you wouldn't all sort of sit and eat together, which actually at the time I was fine with, because I was terrified of everyone else on my wing. I got on very well in my first cell mate, but everyone else on my wing was basically a mentally ill drug addict.
But it's not how you envisage prison.
No, it's like in Paddington, you all sit down and we all sing a song or something. No, not
then make
at
marmalade
all.
Together.
Exactly. But then, so you go back up to your cell, but it's weird then carrying your, and these blue plastic plates that you have with you, and then you go back up to your cell and these tiny, tiny desks, and you sit down at these tiny desks and you have your knees tight together and you sort of eat it. So by the time you got it, it wasn't particularly hot by the time you were served it, but it was cold by the time you got it back. And so you wolf that down by sort of about 11, 11.30, that was your lunch. And then in the afternoon, they would come round and serve you an afternoon meal at your door. So you wouldn't even get out for that. An officer would open the door. Two prisoners, again, with questionable hygiene standards, would then hand you a baguette, very, very, very soggy baguette that had been, you could tell it had been frozen and then reheated with some kind of like chickeny thing filler. And you get like a bag of crisps and a penguin and maybe an apple, but it wasn't.
That was dinner.
That was
at 4 p.m.
And that was about 4 p.m. So you just, and literally you're so hungry, you just inhale it down like sort of Scooby Doo type thing.
And then nothing until
the next day. So you, and again, because I hadn't really eaten during the trial, it's something like, hey, I've got my F-type back, and now suddenly there's no food, which is ironic. So yeah, I did spend a lot of those first few weeks pretty
bloody starving.
So
is everyone
starving.
Very hungry in prison? Does that make everyone quite sort of angsty as well, I'd have thought?
Yeah, and it means that also the meal times are flashpoints for violence. And I saw that quite a lot. Or you'd also see the results of it quite a lot. So sometimes you'd be queuing up your food and you'd sort of look down and you think, oh, my feet are stuck sticking to the floor, and you'd be standing in someone's blood because there'd been a fight there over the food or lack thereof. Once I got onto other wings, once I was off the sort of induction wing where you just basically get served whatever they have, there's supposed to be a system, and again, like everything in prison, it's stupidly convoluted and doesn't really work, where you choose what menu options you want the week before. So you get a slip under your door and it's all handwritten. It's like
in hospital.
Exactly. But in hospital, I suspect they now use like computers for this. In like everything else in prison, it's all done on pen and paper in a grossly inefficient way. And so you then tick, you know, I want the chicken burger one day and I want lasagna the next day, or, you know, whatever it is. But the problem then comes, I stopped caring what I ticked and what I got because it all tasted equally rubbish. But some people, it was really important to them. So when they came to queue up for their food and they got to the front and they said, sorry, we're out of chicken burgers, people would go haywire because it's like they've been thinking about the chicken burger all day, and they say, sorry, you can have chicken burgers. You can have some horrible biryani. And there would be a fight and the officers would come and you know, people get carted off. So food was like, I'd say, the main sort of source of trouble.
And that feeds in, if you excuse the pun, that feeds into the canteen system as well. The canteen's like, I don't want to call it a tuck shop.
It is.
It's kind of like
shop.
A prisoner tuck shop.
Yeah, it's
isn't
a prisoner tuck shop. And that's confusing because people talk about the canteen and they think they mean a canteen where people go and
so
sit down.
So you can buy stuff in the
exactly.
canteen. Okay.
So the canteen is just the name for a prison shop delivery service. It's not a canteen at all.
And not everyone has an equal amount of money, first of all.
No, again, like everything in prison, it's really, really complicated. Chris Grayling, you know, in his ultimate wisdom, made this really convoluted system where everyone, again, back to school, it's like, you know, merits and demerits, basically, prefects and so forth and detentions. So everyone has an IEP level. So when you come in, you're on standard for 2 weeks, and then you then go to... No, you come in entry for 2 weeks. Then you're on standard for a bit. And then if you're really brown-nosed, the officers, you go up to enhanced. And each of these levels has a designated amount of money that you're allowed to spend each week. And it goes up. So when you're on enhanced, and this is if you've got your own money coming in, you can spend up to, I think, £35 a week on the prison shop. But when you start, I think I was only on about £10 a week. But bear in mind, your phone credit comes out of that as well. And without diverting too much, the phone rates in prison are like, they are literally out of 1998. You remember mobiles first came out and you'd call up someone and then £2 later. Yeah. Beep, beep, beep. And it's like that. They set the rates at that. So if you're calling, as most people do, they call mobiles. I mean, who has a landline these days? You're basically, your phone credit was extortionately expensive. So of that £10, in my first few weeks, I had £10 a week. But you'd spend £5 or £6 of that on phone credit. So you'd have then £3 or £4 to spend on, you know, coffee or some extra bread or some biscuits or whatever.
And is that £10 dependent on you having money from coming in externally, or is that just enhanced?
It's stupidly complicated. If people get really bored, they can go and look at the IEP rules in all their glory on the MOJ website if you're having trouble sleeping.
I mean,
so
it's a
combination of the two. If you have no external income and you're not working, and most people couldn't work in the prison, as in doing a prison job or doing education, then you'd be on the quote-unquote unemployed rate, which is 50p a day. So the prison would pay you 50p a day. So if you sat in your cell all day and did nothing and had no external money coming in, you would get 50p a day.
Okay.
Which is, what's that, £3.50?
Yeah. And then you've got to take your phone credit out.
Yeah, and I didn't smoke. Most people in prison smoke. So you've either got to buy your tobacco or burn off that as well. So, yeah, there isn't enough, basically, for you to eat and smoke and call your family.
You also mentioned in the book the packs of tuna that you kept, but you didn't eat the tuna.
I didn't eat tuna. I didn't eat porridge either.
So you, but you,
well.
You used it to trade.
I'm a cliche buster. Yeah.
Tell us about the tuna.
Tuna was like the currency for everything. So even though I never ate the stuff, more of a mackerel kind of guy.
With your first pay packet, you buy mackerel.
I do buy mackerel, and then it didn't turn up because I moved south. But I've still got some mackerel in my cupboard at home. Now, that from prison, that I kept. So when I came out of prison, I thought, oh, because I was eating so much mackerel, I thought, oh, I'll take those home with me. Of course, now you get to the outside world, I don't have... Maybe I should put them as a competition or something.
A copy of the book and some tin.
I know. Some tin princess mackerel. But no, so tuna just was the kind of currency for everything. So if you wanted a haircut, that would be 3 tins of tuna. If you wanted to get your clothes washed, that would be a couple of tins of tuna. If you wanted to curry favour with someone, if you want to thank someone for something, you would just give them tuna. So I would keep stack of tuna by the door to use as kind of bartering tokens.
And was anyone eating it, or was it entirely bartering? Was it just coin? Or
it's an interesting economic theory, isn't it? You're the Bank of England.
Tuna's,
you
know,
you know, devaluing the rate on the tuna exchange today. But the sad thing was, is because a lot of the circle I was in were all white collar people who were all like reading the FT, and they're all sort of some city traders or whatever. They were all kind of making jokes about this and, you know, devaluing the wee economy and so forth. No, I think people did, because there's this idea that people go to prison to bulk up. As you can notice,
protein.
I have done, because obviously I've got this rippling physique in front of me. But most other people, they thought that they'd go to prison, they'd go to the gym and they could work out and build themselves up. So tuna was seen as, I guess, a part of that because of the protein. It wasn't really my kind of scene. So yeah, tuna was just the bartering currency, but I never ate it.
But you did cook in prison. Can you tell us about the cooking side of things?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the thing. You learn very quickly that you cannot survive if you just eat the prison food that the prison serve you. So the first thing you do is, you say, with the canteen, you get these slips under your door each week. And I should have brought them, actually. But there's quite a lot of stuff on there. If you want to get some, you know, tinned olives and stuff like that, or tinned tomatoes and sort of tinned fruit. And you get fresh fruit as well. So actually, in fairness to the system, if you had the money to spend, you could supplement your diet in a reasonably healthy way off those sheets. The only downside was, is there wasn't officially, and I say officially, anywhere to cook. So if you got yourself, you know, some tinned carrots and an onion and some tomatoes or something, you couldn't, and some rice, you couldn't make officially a vegetable curry because there wasn't a kitchen. But what people did, and there was a guy in my book, Scott, who was, I mean, a real, real character. He was like the king of, you know, cheating at prison, basically. He taught me all the tricks. And he taught me how to cook in prison. So he had a spare kettle. And prison kettles, I don't know if they're designed to be this way on purpose, but they have a flat base. So it means that you can just use them to cook. You can use them. It's like a frying pad or something. So you could chop an onion, put that in. You could chop a pepper, put that in. Fry all that up, some chili, some garlic, and then put some tomatoes in, put in some pre-cooked chicken.
Sounds lovely.
And I tell you, the thing I learned to use more than anything else in prison was couscous. I never really understood the point of couscous before prison, and now I put it in everything because it just thickened everything up and really it just made you feel fuller as well. But so every meal would always put a handful of couscous.
How often would you be cooking like this? I mean, is it every day? Or?
Every day, yeah, pretty much.
So once, you supplement the meals that you'll give them?
No, well, it actually turned on its head that when Scott and I would do our orders for the week about what we were going to get from the servery, there would be a chicken salad option, which would just be a cold couple of legs of chicken or chicken thigh and some lettuce. So we would both order that, bring that back at 4, leave it on the side, and then when 7 o'clock came, we would then scrape all the chicken bits off and use that in our meal. So we would use their stuff as raw ingredients with all the other things we were buying in order to make a nice meal. We would sit down at 7 or 8 o'clock and just have a nice meal.
And this might be a stupid question, but how are you chopping the vegetables? What are you using? Because presumably you're not allowed blades.
They have prison knives, so you have plastic knives.
What, as in the type you get just in a canteen?
Yeah.
Or?
Yeah.
And that's what you use for?
That's what we would use.
Right.
And are they okay with you boiling water? I would have thought they were this.
Yeah, everyone gets a kettle. So you that's the thing, you were officially allowed. So we had two kettles. So we had a kettle for boiling water. And this is the one thing you never want to do, is make a cup of tea in the kettle you've been using to cook food.
That does sound quite disgusting.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes, occasionally, mistakes were made. So you would have your official kettle, which is for boiling water, and you would use that to then make your rice and pasta and all that kind of stuff. And then you would have your other kettle, which was for your food and your chopping and your veg and everything else like that.
And there's a sort of good reason why food tastes rubbish in prison.
Yes.
that you were explained to us before the record.
Yes.
Can you tell us about that? You encountered it when you were brought onto a tasting team.
Yes, I got onto a weird number of focus groups. I don't know why this happened. And again, it was not what you expect in prison. It's like, oh, I did shitloads of focus groups. God, not another one. I used to hide from them. They always come for me. Because I'm relatively articulate and I can talk to authority, and a lot of people there aren't, and they just didn't want to talk to authority. They didn't want to engage. So they were like, oh yeah, get him. He'll chat. I'd go on all sorts of folks. Anyway, but the biscuits were normally good, and you'd talk to other people who weren't prisoners. So it was actually nice, a way to sort of get decent conversation. And the one folks group I did that was fascinating was a tasting session, because they were going to do new menus for the whole of the prison system for the next year. And they decided to do this tasting session at Wandsworth. And they got 5 prisoners along, of which I was one, to come and taste all the food. And it was the best day inside, because the food all tasted amazing. It was all delicious. It was hot. It was properly cooked. It was well seasoned. And I completely gorged on it. I didn't eat for like days afterwards. And at the end, I said to the head of the kitchens, why does all this taste fantastic? Like, I gave 10 in the scorecards. Everything was a 10. Why does all this taste fantastic? And why does everything I eat, no offence, but everything I eat from your kitchen taste like shit, basically? And he said one word, strange ways. And he told me the story of the Strange Ways riot that had obviously happened about 25 years before, where prisoners took over what was then Strange Ways prison for weeks. And they were up on the roof, and it was a massive national scandal because they couldn't get them down, and they were actually rioting about fairly, just things like the use of liquid cosh, which was used as a sort of injected sedative, and people were slopping out, i.e. going to the loo in their cells. Anyway, this riot went on and on and on, and it made the government very, very embarrassed. And the reason the riot went on so long was because it started in the kitchen, which at that point was in the centre of all these Victorian prisons. And they got control of the kitchen, which meant that they could feed themselves, and the riot went on and on and on. So one of the consequences of Strange Ways was to take the kitchens off the central site of all those big Victorian prisons. So it's not in the centre anymore, which was a very easy, convenient place to serve food onto the wings. It's now in a completely separate building, surrounded by barbed wire and, dogs and all the rest of it, so that if there is a riot now, and there have been riots, it only goes on for a day or two because there's no food. So it is quite sensible. But what it means is when the food is cooked off-site, as it is, it then takes hours in some cases to wheel these trolleys from the kitchens to the wing. So by the time they come to serve it to us, it's cold and congealed and nasty. So it didn't matter how nice the stuff was tasting in my tasting session, it would never taste anything like that again, because there's 4 hours between oven and plate.
Chris, you mentioned earlier the jobs that people had. And I mean, how do they go about allocating people jobs? How do you get a job in a kitchen?
Who wants to know? Yeah, there's a few backs need to be scratched on that one. I found it fascinating how the kind of the hierarchies of the outside world, and in some ways the hierarchies of the criminal fraternity, all sort of replicated themselves in prisons, but within these little departments. So I was in the education department, and that's sort of where middle-class, non-violent people like me sort of ended up. But the more kind of rougher, tougher drug dealer types would normally sort of end up in the kitchens. And it was a massive sort of patronage system. You know, you needed to know the right person and to do a favour for them, and they would get you a nice job in the kitchens. I mean, jobs were so important in Wandsworth, not because people wanted to help the system. I mean, it sounds bizarre that everyone wanted a good job. You'd think, well, hang on, they've just put you away. Why should you want to help them? But the alternative is being locked in your cell for 23 hours a day. And if you spend a week on permanent bang-up, you will do anything to get out your cell.
And that is how, just to be clear, that is how the prisoners run.
90% of what, when I was there, they do tell me it's got better, which I'm not sure I believe or not. But when I was there, 90% of the prisoners were locked in their cells 23 hours a day, which just does send you completely around the bend. And that's why spice use is so high, because, you know, they just use the spice to kind of, you know, get through that kind of trauma.
Spice being a particular prison drug.
A very dangerous synthetic form of cannabis.
That's very difficult to detect.
Can't detect it. Sniffer dogs, you can't show up in urine tests or anything like that, and it's very easy to smuggle in.
But how does spice make people behave?
There's spice attacks, so people just pass out. They just go completely unconscious, and they literally hit the deck. You'd hear them going thump, thump, thump above you, or make them extraordinarily violent as well. So it's a combination of those two things. So you want to be out yourself. So you would get a job to get or get on a course. So you could either get onto, you know, a barbering course or dry lining. Didn't know what it was, but I did it. And I joke, you know, I'd have joined Islamic State to get out of the cell. I mean, you know, literally, you're just like, I don't care what it is, just get me out of it.
People are signed up to multiple religions, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
People, you talk about, actually, you talk about the teetotal Muslims attending the AA meetings.
Muslims at AA, that's always summed up Wandsworth for me. And you got these jobs, but also you got out of the cell, it got you about a bit, and it gave you some influence then. If you were out, you were sort of, suddenly you were in a sort of different sort of slipstream of prison life, and then you could do favours for people do you more favours, it gave you a degree of power. Also meant you had more phone access. You know, if you were, I had a young son who wanted to call as much as possible, so the more often I was out of the cell, the more chances I got to phone home and talk to my son. If you tried to do it in the normal association periods, it was very, very noisy. There were long queues. It was quite difficult getting on the phone then. But if you were just out doing a job, quote unquote, it meant you could just pick up the phone and just call home whenever, really. So once you got a job, say by knowing the right people, scratching the right backs. I mean, I got my first decent job as education orderly because my cellmate was education orderly. He got a better job. And I said, oh, well, can I take yours? And he said, yeah, fine. It's as simple as that. So the kitchens was seen as one of the prime jobs because you've got more access to food. But it sort of, he was swings and roundabouts, because one thing Scott taught me is, he said, you know, he's Australian, he said, you don't need to work in the kitchen, mate, you just need to know people who work in the kitchen. So Scott, and he used his real name there, Scott in the book, he was great because he would do favors. He was a great admin sage, so he was always filling in forms for people, because a lot of people couldn't read or write, or a lot of people didn't really understand the bureaucracy of the prison system. So he would do favors for people. He would write all their appeals to them, he'd write out all their applications, everything was handwritten, and then in return people would just give us food. So when I first moved in with Scott, I was just sat at the table reading a paper, and there's this bang on the door, this enormous Algerian turned up, and I thought, oh God, what's he going to do to me? And he says, give me your hands. So I held up my hands, and he put like four chicken thighs in my hands and just walked off. Didn't explain why or whatever. And I put them aside, and I was like, this enormous Algerian. He's like, oh yeah, yeah, I did his recap appeal. Yeah, yeah, that's fine. So, but that was fine. So then I learned from Scott that you do favour, you help people who work in the kitchen, and then they will just give you nice food in return for that. So there's a massive, massive black market.
And there's also Scott's tip on bulk theft.
Bulk theft, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. If you steal one thing, you'll get screwed. If you steal 20 things, they assume you're doing it officially and they hold the gate open for you. Yeah. I should say he was in prison for £60 million share fraud, so maybe... Maybe we shouldn't take his advice, you know, at 100% face value. So it doesn't always work. But inside, people like him absolutely thrived.
And what did you crave while you're inside?
Oh, God. I mean, initially, everything. Oh, food, women, cigarettes, alcohol, a lot of alcohol.
Well, you gave up smoking, a slight tangent there, but you gave up smoking when you came into prison, is that right?
Yeah, well, I've always been one of those really annoying social smokers. So I've only ever smoked when I drank alcohol. And that's my trigger. So I'll go for a day, if I'm not drinking, I won't go near a cigarette. Mm. And the second I have two or three glasses of wine, I suddenly want a fag. And I've always been like that. So going inside, the one thing you couldn't get really in prison was booze. I think there was some hooch going around, but I didn't want to drink it. So, yeah, I did crave alcohol once I got in. And then I'm sure if I'd had a drink, I'd have started smoking again immediately. Because I couldn't have alcohol, I also then didn't want cigarettes. Mm. So I went cold turkey on both at the same time. And it was okay. I was very much kind of out of sight, out of mind. But the problem was always like Echo Falls ads on the TV or booze ads. Do you see what I mean? And then suddenly you're just like, oh, I want a drink, I want a drink. But after about a month or two, it just goes. The cravings go.
This might seem a strange question, but I mean, did you sort of feel healthier in prison if you weren't drinking, weren't smoking, cooking?
Didn't have a daylight. Once I got in with Scott, everything changed. He was a listener, and just as a quick diversion, listeners are sort of super trusted prisoners who
they're trained by the Samaritans.
Trained by the Samaritans to help other inmates who are suicidal, self harming, or just off their heads, or just really upset, which is most of the prison population pretty much. So anyone can call for a listener day or night, and you're on call to come sit with them and listen to them and counsel them and you know, just listen to their, you know, woes and sorrows. And I did that for about 6 months, and that's how I got in with Scott. And he's one of the many perks of the job was you had an extra big cell. It was more of a like a flat. It was probably about a bit bigger than this room we're in now, the Spectators, lovely offices. So it was huge compared to other cells. So, and that had a nice table, it had a cooking area, you know, it was a nice separate sleeping area and everything else. So once I moved in with Scott, I got into the listening and I got into the super big cell. We call it the executive suite. And he was the one who said, don't eat the food straight off the server. Use its ingredients and start to eat better. So my diet improved radically. I was out of my cell a lot more, so I got to do a lot more exercise. And yeah, I just got healthier. I definitely got healthier. And I came out of prison a lot healthier than
I was. How long were you inside for?
So I was in Wandsworth for 9 months, which is like the proper prison. And then I was 21 months in open prison, which doesn't really count. I describe it as shit butlins, basically.
What was because you don't really talk about that in the book, because you say it's not as interesting.
It's
what
just
was the food
boring.
Like?
What was the food like? Better, a lot better. Oh my God, when I got to Ford, it was incredible. Because it was like long tables. There was a special seating.
There was communal dining.
There was community because you can just go wherever you want. It's not like in Wandsworth, there's locked gates everywhere. If you want to go everywhere, you need an officer with you. You need to hang by the gate and try and blag your way through.
And you're on bang up for 23 hours a day.
Yeah. And there's no, it's all wings. There's no sort of space for people to congregate. We're open prison. It's just like a series of huts, basically. Unless it had prison on the thing outside, you wouldn't see it. It's a prison. In fact, Ford used to be an RAF base. So it's all army billets, old army billets. They flew out of there in the Second World War. So, yeah, there was just a big, big, the mess hall, essentially. And some people went back to their rooms, so they want to watch a bit of TV. Other people sat and chatted with their mates and everything. So, yeah, the food was, if you went there now, you'd probably turn your noses up at it. But if you spent 9 months in Wandsworth, it was the fucking
Ritz.
It's
in perspective.
Yeah. And it was the quantity. There was lots of it. And they did great fry-ups on Saturday. So the Saturday fry-ups were pretty good. Now, I hadn't had a fry up for 9 months, and I like my fry ups. And then on this first day, someone said to me, "Do you want seconds?" And I almost started crying. I know, literally, I couldn't believe you can actually go and get seconds. So that was fantastic. And then when I got to Spring Hill, because I was sort of very well behaved, and I was doing a psychology degree, which I've just finished, I completed my psychology degree at Oxford Brookes. So I went to Spring Hill Prison, which is in Oxfordshire, and it's very close to Oxford. So I went to Oxford Brookes every day. So for my last 15 months of my sentence, I was going out into the community for 12 hours. Oh my God, my first 2 days, I had a Wagamama's, I had a Burger King. I was just, and I couldn't sleep because I had so many cappuccinos, I shit you not. And I was lying in my bed at 2 a.m. going, "Why can't I sleep?" I must have 6 cappuccinos I had. So yeah, I absolutely gorged again on the finer things in life.
Is there anything you got a taste for in prison food-wise that you miss, or are you just glad to see the back of it?
No, not really. I'm just trying to think. I mean, mackerel was sort of the creme de la creme, because initially when you get in, everything's weighted by cost, obviously. So you sit down, you've either got your £10 or your £15 or your £20, and it goes up and up every few weeks. And what are you going to spend it on? And So you start off with your basic, you know, tin tuna or whatever, or your basic biscuits. And then as you start to get more money, you start to spend it on the next level up, and then the next thing, and then the next. You don't have the tuna in brine anymore. You might have the tuna with sunflower oil, you know, and so forth. So you're, but the thing is, you'll spend several weeks kind of looking on the canteen sheet. You're looking at what you can't afford and thinking, God, I can't wait to get that. And then you get, so the noodles as well, in particular, I remember the noodles were sort of on four different levels, from your basic to your not that bad. And when you finally got those pot curry noodles, you were just like, oh my God, this is absolutely, this is amazing. It's like, as a child, it's like delayed gratification, I guess. You spent weeks thinking about that pot curry noodle. So when you finally get it, you just think, oh, this is absolutely amazing. And canteen day was so important. It was the highlight of the week. When that plastic bag was delivered at your door, it was like Christmas morning, honestly. It was so exciting. So canteen became, and it was also like a way of marking the weeks. You know, time is everything in prison. You're basically there to do time. You are there just to spend time not being in society. So canteen meant that's another week gone. And there was always a kind of rush that you'd get when the canteen kind of came in. You'd say, oh, order, you know, and there'd be sort of some matchmakers or some joysticks or something like that. And the sad thing was, I guess, is when you sort of got to open prison, it was like growing up, I guess. You know, it's like a kid. You're not a kid anymore. The presents aren't as exciting.
You're allowed everything.
You're allowed everything now. So you just stop bothering with the canteen. And you'd sort of walk past the other people who'd just come from closed prisons, go, oh, canteen. It's like this big, big thing. And you're like, yeah, I'm going to have a Wagamama's on my way home now, you know. And it just lost its sort of, its potency, I guess. So, and that all sort of degraded over my time at Open, that, you know, because I was going home at the weekends to see my son and stuff and going to restaurants again and stuff. So the canteen lost its sort of magical, its magical power. And now I look at these pot noodles going, the fuck could I have a pot noodle? You know, but back then it was the height of luxury.
Now that you're out, and obviously you've kind of learned all of this stuff about cooking in prison, I mean, has it changed your attitude to food? Has it changed how you cook now?
Oh, yeah, you certainly appreciate stuff a lot more. And if anything, I have kind of started to put on weight because I eat more now. I think when you've had that taken away from you, or you've had, like, the sensation of taste really taken away from you, now it's just everything tastes so much better. But it just means that I do stuff my face a lot more than I used to. I didn't have desserts before, and now I always have desserts and snacks and things like that. So I do find I am just eating more, which is not necessarily a bad thing. I was probably quite underweight before. So yeah, no, you just appreciate everything. And I'll annoy my friends because I just keep going, oh, this is so good, this is delicious, and they're talking about Brexit or something like that, but this is rejoicing, this is amazing, yeah, after all this, what's that? So yeah, you do, and I don't ever want to lose that, really, because you can get very complacent. You can sit and, you know, be very first world problems, can't you, and think, you know, God, isn't life tough because my steak is, I ordered it medium rare, it's actually rare, you know, so I just eat the damn thing, you know, just it's better than Wandsworth. That's what I always say. It's better than Wandsworth.
Chris, thank you so much for joining our podcast. And Chris's new book, A Bit of a Stretch, is out now.
Thank you for joining us on the Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website. Destin sans différence.